three additional folks arriving. We're going to put David Johnson on the telephone, particularly if someone will help me with that. Gina's got the phone number we're supposed to call, I think.
I'll get it.
If you don't mind. John called and was in traffic around Concord, I think, New Hampshire at some point. So, but he will be along shortly, as will Jim Moore be along fairly shortly. But I think we can get going as soon as we get Jim on. David Johnson on. What I think, at least the agenda I've got sketched out, is to do introductions, then talk a little bit about the process. Both about the process for the day and the process for the bigger picture, and then try and dive into the work. The work of the day, as I said, is to try and get specified out some requirements. What is it that something like this needs and looks like? Hang on just a moment till we get David, if that's all right. Oh, by the way, I mentioned, as I think went around in the email from Gina, we will be recording today unless anybody has an objection. This is one of the things that the Berkman Center is good at, is just keeping records, and recorded records are as good as anything in doing this. We're not podcasting it live. And we may try and select out some bits and pieces for the website or something like that, but we will check in with you before we put you up on our web. That's okay with people.
Hello.
What is that, David?
Yes, hi, Oliver.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, sorry, I didn't have to call in earlier. I got a number, but not a passcode.
Ah, okay. Well, don't worry about that. We're just getting going ourselves. We're slightly on
okay.
Harvard University time, so we're a little not to the point. We're getting going. David, you're on the train, is it, between Washington and New York?
Yeah, I'm going through a tunnel. We're about to cut out, probably.
Okay. What is the passcode so we can call back in? We know the passcode.
Oh, we're just calling him directly.
Okay, we're just calling him directly. David, what is there?
He
a
just calls back if he hangs up on his caller ID.
Okay, do you have the caller ID on this, David? Do we have a number?
Yeah, let me look it up.
David?
Okay, no, that's fine. That's all.
David?
You there?
Yes, David. You hear me?
Yep.
Sebastian will give you our number here in just a moment. If you go through the tunnel and get cut off, we're not using the anything of it. You're our only caller in, so you just call directly to the number that's either on
okay.
this or that Sebastian will give you. That would be great.
Okay.
Okay. Great. All right. The first thing on the list is just to go around the table and introduce. Many of you know who each other are, but if you don't mind going around just to who you are and what your function, and a brief, just a sentence or two on your background, that would be great. Why don't we come around this way? Brock, you want to?
I'm Brock Rutter. I'm Professor Goodenough's research assistant. I'm a recent graduate of Vermont Law School, and I've been working with him on the Law Lab project since November.
And has just, if I can brag on him a moment, has just been hired by Vermont to help digitize the divorce process in uncontested cases. They've got a project to put that online, and he's just gotten the job of overseeing that. So,
cool,
right?
Yeah, okay. Sort of. real law online.
Exactly. Law I hope to never implement. My name is Sebastian Diaz. I'm the chief geek at the Berkman Center. Oversee all the technology stuff, and I guess it's a good place to be here at the zero floor, I guess, to see the beginning of this.
And Berkman Center is one of those great places in the world where geek is a term of praise rather than anything else. So yes,
I'm Caroline Nolan. I'm a research associate here at Berkman. I work on a couple different projects and just began working on the Law Lab a couple weeks ago. So I'm in the process of coming up to speed, but mostly in a supportive role. So it's nice to meet you all.
She is one of our chief implementers, so we are glad to have her be part of all this.
And I'm Peter Early. I'm a lawyer in Burlington, Vermont. I've been working with Professor Goodenough on the revisions to the virtual corporate law to accommodate virtual entities. Last year I did that with him, and since then I've been working with David Johnson, who may or may not be on the phone still, I'm not sure. And we've been working on getting up and going a hosting company perhaps to house virtual companies once they're formed. And actually I'm in contact with a couple other groups of people who are interested in setting them up right now. So we're trying to do it on the fly, sort of working with actual people interested in doing this at the same time as participating in this project. So this is very interesting for me to have an opportunity to do this. So thanks for letting me participate.
You're also a partner at the firm of
Gravel and Shea. That's right. I'm a partner in the firm of Gravel and Shea, which is by Vermont standards, a fairly large firm. We actually have 25 lawyers, so which is nothing compared by Boston standards. But anyway, yes, I'm a partner at Gravel and Shea, and I do corporate law there.
Excellent. So my name is Urs Gasser. I'm the new executive director of the Berkman Center. I'm a co-PI on the Law Lab project. I have a very strong personal interest in the stuff we're discussing today. I've been thinking a long time about digital institutions and like the interaction between law and innovation. So here, in a way, all comes together, and it's very exciting to be here. And I'm certainly very grateful that Oliver kind of leads us through this track, this part of the Law Lab, and I'm very much looking forward to collaborating with all of you.
Well, and I should mention that it was just about a year ago that Urs Gasser first mentioned the words Law Lab or Legal Laboratory to a gathering from which all of this then emerged. So you are indeed one of the founders of the feast.
So I'm Lydia Chilton. I'm a grad student at MIT in the computer science department, and part of what I've been working on is software for economists to write cooperation games. And I've met with Jim Moore, don't know if you know him, but he wanted to talk to me some about the technical details, and he thought that it might be relevant for some of the Law Lab projects that we're working on here. So I'm here really to observe and to lend any technical expertise I can, I suppose.
Well, we hope that one of our hopes is that your project at MIT and our projects here can have a productive interaction, and so it's great to have you here. I know have to take off at some point to fly to
Seattle. Yeah.
So you'll be leaving us probably a little before we adjourn.
Right.
David, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm David Johnson. I teach at New York Law School, and I've been working on the virtual company project for 3 years or so now. And Peter Early and I, as he has said, are trying to figure out how to make it real.
Again, David, in fact, has has been working this probably longer than any of us in terms of thinking about what a virtual company might look like, and has a very interesting and developed vision on where this can all go. So it's great to have you on, David. Thank you for being willing to participate by phone. I'm Oliver Goodenough. I'm a professor at the Vermont Law School and a fellow here at Berkman Center and one of the co-directors of the Law Lab. And as is mentioned, this is this project is one of the ones that is particularly in my track there, so we're pushing on. Two people who will be joining us shortly are John Clippinger. John is the other co-director of the Law Lab project, deeply involved in digital institutions of all kinds and interested in particular in this piece. And also Jim Moore, and Jim is a software specialist and entrepreneur, but also has a background in social science and other. Kinds of he straddles the academic and the software, and is one of our design advisors on how this all goes forward. Okay, so other we're all set. All right, process the day. I'll go through the agenda in a moment. As our hope for an end product is to come out with a reasonably
developed statement of requirements, not a final one, but a reasonably developed statement of requirements. And that leads us into that question of, well, what is a statement of requirements? I've been being educated in how one develops software. And one of the key early steps is to figure out what it's supposed to do. And what it's supposed to do is independent of, at least at this phase, independent of how one would actually write the software to do it. At least in theory, part of the approach is to not let the software, some early software decisions, dictate what you can do, but rather hopefully the other way around, what we need to do. So our job really today is, with the help and guidance of our technology people, to begin to rough out what is it that a piece of software would do that we would substitute for the classic operating agreement in an LLC. And against that, on the bigger picture project, that we're really pulling together two or three pieces. Most of you are aware of this, but if you don't mind us just going back over, I think it will be helpful a little bit to go back over. The whole notion grows out of this some Berkman work and David Johnson's work on digital institutions, Ursa's work. What happens when you migrate the private economic institutions into the digital world? And we had a conference on this about 2 or 3 years ago, and at least from my standpoint, that opened a lot of my eyes to this and helped to bring about this initiative in Vermont to say there are legal authorization for doing that has to be in place. Most of the private economic laws have tended to be in a paper and telegram kind of era in terms of their what they contemplate. So Vermont passed this law which authorizes corporations and LLCs to be set up using almost entirely digital means for their internal operations and things like that. Now, work to date has gone forward on this. Peter and David have developed some initial models. Peter, David, do you want to bring us up just to speed a little bit on what you've been up to and what our packet has Peter's materials in it, as well as David's email.
Go ahead, Peter. I'll chime in if I.
Okay. All right. Let's look at through the materials here. You'll see in here there's sort of three I think pieces of it up to the materials that I at least sent in. One, the first one is a prototype. What Dave and I have come up with is a limited liability company operating agreement. And just for purposes of background, what an operating agreement does is basically define the relationships of everybody who is a participant in the enterprise or the entity, and they're called members. And the members then have various rights, which are defined by this agreement. And so what we've tried to do here in this operating agreement is to capture what we thought might make sense for a sort of a so-called virtual limited liability company, so how it would work. And so you'll see here some pieces regarding contributing work product to the enterprise, some other language regarding how the economics of the enterprise would work, some other language regarding how the decisions would be made, and some other things regarding how the entity would be set up. And so that's sort of what we have right now. This is our working model prototype agreement, and the idea is that it would be fairly flexible. And there's a provision in here which allows decisions to be made by people who are members or participants in the enterprise. And that paragraph is intended to capture some flexibility, build in some flexibility into the operating agreement and the relationship, which then they can move on from this agreement to sort of implement as need be in a particular company context. Because every one of these companies is going to be different from others, and we need to have some flexibility. So that's what we try to do here. I also went ahead, there's an operating agreement questionnaire, which is designed to basically react, sort of elicit reactions to this prototype operating agreement by asking people, do they like what's in here, reading it, and if not, how do you want to change it? And so it's a pretty primitive questionnaire, and I'm sure this group is going to be one of the things I think it may consider doing is trying to elaborate on sort of how this agreement might be varied through use of questionnaire or some sort of way of getting some feedback to what's in here. But that's what this questionnaire is, a primitive way of sort of asking people, gee, do you like what's in here? And if not, tell us how it should be changed.
The third thing I've included in here is just a questionnaire, which we actually use in my office, my law firm. It's not designed for virtual companies. It's just to indicate sort of what you would do in a more garden variety LLC. What are the issues you would have in terms of setting up any limited liability company? What should you be discussing, thinking about in terms of setting it up? So this is not something that's intended to be applicable to virtual companies per se. It's intended to be sort of broadly applicable to limited liability companies.
And indeed, it's a very nice summary of a lot of the kinds of issues. And in some ways, where I think we're headed a little more today isn't necessarily at the conclusion of your thought process, which is a good conclusion, but at the generic pieces of it. So in some ways, that operating agreement questionnaire, the more general one, it actually is a very, very useful document, I think, for us in terms of figuring out what it is we're up to. Yeah. Sorry, you're bouncing in and out, David.
David?
I think that was that cutoff.
Huh. Well, I was going to talk a little bit more about what he and I have been doing, but maybe I should wait for him to get back.
I have a number for him. Sorry, I didn't give it to him yet. We can call him right back.
Okay, why don't you call him right back? Was talking about tunnels, he's probably near Baltimore.
Oh, that's what he...
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic...
Oh, perfect. We'll try in a minute or two. But again, to go back, at least part of what we're aiming for is really to get what would be generic, what is not necessarily to implement any particular vision, but rather to make a set of software that could be generic on this. If at least some of the thinking.
I think you got the number. Hello there.
Oliver?
Yes.
Hi, sorry, David, I dropped off there.
That's all right.
I wanted to make two quick points.
Yeah.
First of all, there is a draft that I think was attached to one of my emails, but it's also on Vermont Virtual, of a requirements document that speaks to what I thought was necessary for a hosting system to enable the members of a virtual company to do the essential corporate company business together, that is, say, allocate jobs and decide who gets to participate in net proceeds and make decisions together. So the baseline document, that you might look at, it's not applicable to every possible variation of a virtual company. You had said something about having a system substitute for the operating agreement, and I think that the challenge here is not to replace the operating agreement, but to build on it to create an environment where people coming together only online can coordinate their activities in various ways.
Well, stepping way back, David, obviously one of the questions here is what is it that we're trying to do at the most sort of abstracted level, and what we're trying to do again is to provide a legal framework within which people can design their own arrangements for as you say coming together and cooperating around projects, and whether that's three guys in a plumbing service or 100,000 in a wiki kind of company. Our hope is to have a structure that will accommodate both ends of that spectrum. Obviously, the details will be very different, but at least some of the structure may well look very similar at an abstracted level. And the LLC is a way of doing that. You know, the U.S. has six or seven different legal frameworks within which it recognizes people can do that. But the LLC is one of the most flexible, so I think that's one of the reasons we're focusing in on it as a beginning point.
Okay. Well, are you trying to cover cases in which there's no legal person created, no entity?
And the answer to that is not today, because the law that we're dealing with is the LLC law that is the empowering law, and the LLC law says, by the way, come here and we'll make a legal entity. So I think that we're aiming mainly at that at the moment. But within that legal entity space, we are looking to be very, very broad.
Okay.
As David's pointing out, well, one of the things that this does is sometimes create a legal entity. There are other kinds of associations that need not have legal entities. But at least the current trend of U.S. law is very much to use the legal entity format for most economic cooperative interaction. Okay. In terms of just finishing off on work to date,
Carolyn, would you be able to? I apologize, but would you be able to find online if you go to the what is it? It's vermontvirtual.org. Is that right, David?
Yes.
Vermontvirtual.org. If you would find that requirements list, it would probably be good to have see if we could get that.
Oh, actually,
you have it in.
Oh, we have it in the is that in the email?
It's additional, right, Dave? It's a right.
Okay, it's in the email. Okay, good. Never mind. We've got it there. We've got it here. We got it there. Urs, anything more from your end that you want to?
Not right now.
Okay. What I'd like us to think about really then is that level of abstractedness that I've tried to take a stab at. I know David has taken a stab at. Peter Early's questionnaire is kind of a stab at, which is can we get a list of the kind of functionalities? What are the things that the topics that people appear to want to decide and all. The law itself has its own set of those topics. It purports to be relatively complete, but I think it's actually still an artifact of its time and place, as is all our list. But I think it'd be great to get that down. I've got a starting point in my email that I sent out, but it would be good to go through and see how those all map up if we can do that. If we go to my email, if you'll permit me to use that as a starting point, I had listed this one here: contributions, assignment of tasks, allocation of revenues, distribution of revenues and losses, decision making. One piece that struck me on that list as being needed to be adding was dispute resolution.
Thank you, Oliver.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I apologize. It's also clearly on. If we go to Peter's more generalized questionnaire, I think if I recall in there that we've got that as part of that. Is it in that? Yes, dispute resolution provisions right on the first page. What do we see as other or elaborations?
Well, one way I like to think of these things, just so I don't lose track of them, of the various elements, Oliver, based on your list, is what I try to do is when I'm actually talking to clients about it is sort of step back a pace and sort of think of, gee, what are the groups of things, what are the three or four big categories of stuff you need to think about in terms of setting one of these companies up?
Mm-hmm.
And just to try to keep it somewhat simple, what I try to do is sort of, I think of it as sort of three or maybe four things.
Okay.
And the three or four things consist of, number one, what sort of business is it in, and sort of what are people, the first elements of your chart here, what are people going to be participating in terms of contributions and capital and that sort of thing. So it's the business / capital, what is it going to be doing? The second piece of it is, how are we going to share in the economic benefits, hopefully, derived from this business? Who's going to be paid for doing what? And how is that going to work? So it's an economics piece. A third piece is what I usually talk about as governance, or who's going to manage it, and who's going to get voting rights, and what are the voting rights going to consist of, and over what? So how does it run itself? And then the fourth piece is, okay, exit-related things. How do you, are you allowed to transfer your interests? This is maybe more generic. David and I don't let this happen very much in ours. But typically you would have issues related to who gets to sell their interests under what circumstances, so when does a company sell its interests under what circumstances, you know, when does it sell itself, and that sort of thing. So, and then, you know, so those are the four basic categories. There may be some miscellaneous things like dispute resolution that aren't captured by that, but that's kind of the way I'd like to walk people through one of these things and then start grouping decisions under those categories in terms of keeping track of building something.
So I have a question. I mean, I'm also a lawyer, so I understand what you're describing. What I was wondering about when I read the documents is, would it be an approach, at least a way to think about it, and to ask, where do we see actually the conflicts and the bad things happening the most in practice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So approaching it like from a different angle, instead of thinking about the appropriate structure as we would frame the document,
Yeah.
To ask, where do we see problems actually? Right? So very much a problem-based approach. If the assumption is right that where we see problems emerge in practice between shareholders, management shareholders, and so forth, that these are also the potential areas of improvement. So going back to your first step, we certainly want to kind of transform company from the paper world to the digital world and replicate basically what we need to replicate based on the current laws. But at the same time, I think even while doing that, we already may want to be more creative and think what can we do differently and where can we improve, right? So it's not to say this is a different model, but I think it could be helpful in prioritizing things.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, you know, you would have some areas that deserve more attention than others. So clearly, for instance, the governance structure, right, often creates problems. Exit is usually a big problem. You know, share of revenues, well, can be, but usually you have a pretty good clause in your contracts and in the bylaws and so forth describing that. So that's just a thought, right?
Right. No.
You don't have to do it right now, but like just as we move forward, probably to have like a different layer or a different way to look at things, which is more oriented towards problems that we see in practice with, you know, the usual companies we're familiar with, and tend to ask ourselves, what could it mean while we move to this digital environment, and what does it mean for our design choices, basically? So it's just...
I think the first big problem we're tackling with this digital paradigm is just the immense transaction costs of everything, rather than the substantive problems.
Yeah.
Just putting this all digital to just make it more efficient, I think, is the number one problem.
Well, and also making all kinds of things possible that weren't, including collaborations across huge distances, across larger groups of people. I should mention in passing, by the way, that this is another piece that I want to make sure we weave in as we go forward. I think this is a very good one, is the question of what are the new environments that are out there. Yochai Benkler has, for instance, done that work on what are the possibilities of massive collaboration and or social network value creation and that kind of thing. And we want to make sure that we capture, you know, the abilities to do those things, as well as the more traditional forms that you and I are used to in our structuring. Okay, I think that so we will keep this both as a goal to make sure that we've got the dispute resolution itself built into the thing, but also use the questions of where the disputes arrive as a backward design tool as well. I think that's a very good point. By the way, when I was in practice, I tried to do some of the things that Peter has very nicely routinized here, and that underlies some of what is on my list, including some of the teaching of it. Do you mind we go through then your let's go through in a little more detail perhaps your piece here, just if you don't mind, Peter. issues, you have the transfer, buyout, buy, sell. That's really your exit grouping. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Then dispute resolution, obviously, there's that as well, our specifying process.
Right.
Voting and governance issues. One of the things that as we've been thinking a bit about this is this question of what it is that governance means. What does it mean when you have governance and voting? Because if we can think about abstracting and interrelating a little bit, one of the questions here is as you break it down to kind of a go/no-go kind of logic, is it fair to say that governance is really a question of what are the release points? Is that a fair way to think about it? What is it that allows something to happen? I very much liked your notion of what are the activities of this company, and activities require resource and all of that, but it also to act requires, the freedom to act. What is the points of authority? What is the points where we say yes, we can do X? David, are you there?
Yes, I am. I think the answer to that differs a lot depending on whether you're trying to include peer production generally or whether you're focusing entirely on the creation of a legal entity that can own a set of assets and take action. And then in that context, the question is, how do you determine what is a decision that binds the entity? It's either in a traditional company, it would be a decision by the board or an officer or whatever. Since we're proposing to do away with that hierarchical structure, you then have to specify in the operating agreement that the company can make decisions by either taking a vote or by delegating particular decisions to identified people who can act on its behalf.
So at least some of the question about the decision is binding is that external relations question about are we going to bind it into the outside world? Who has the authority and on what basis to act in dealing with the outside world? But then there's also, in a sense, the kind of questions of the internal authority essentially about directions to the entity, choices that it makes, that kind of thing as well. Or is that a real distinction? Is it always in relation to the outside world? Or
no, I don't see it as a key distinction, because if it has relationships with members, it's the it that has the relationships that has to have a decision-making structure. I'm also a little troubled by what I hear here is a notion that we want to open up all possible options in some kind of software context. And it's not the case that all possible options are equally available or desirable or even legally permitted. So, for example, to go back to the transferability point, if you allow people to select a relationship in which they are creating a legal entity and the interests are transferable, you have allowed them to put themselves into a completely different legal regime with regard to security, potentially, and so forth. So if I question whether the goal here should be to create a system that is enabling all possible options as opposed to enabling a few very well-selected options that people then can understand and deal with.
David, I'm, at least in my own thinking at this point, I want to make sure we understand what the generic looks like. We may carve out various end products at that point, but in order to do the programming correctly, or as correctly as we can, I think that it's useful to think about these things generically, and then as you raise the point, we may decide down the road that the actual software that is offered to the public says, do it this way, or do it that way, or not. But at least in my own thinking, I'm trying to figure out where do you drop in. For instance, if we think about it, I'm jumping to software at the moment. But if you think about it as a chain of decisions tree kind of approaches, then what is it that we're asking it to do? You could drop in if you're saying in order to instruct the bank to pay money, there must be a decision. And if that decision is the content of that decision could be it's because David Johnson says so. You know, we could have a group of members, and they, you could be the managing member. It could be because a majority of the people with points earned under the design of agreement that you and Peter put together said so. But
yes, I agree with that. But okay, I think the other distinction that may be important here is the distinction between what the software has to do in the context of formation and what the software has to do in the context of operation of the company.
Okay. And the software needs to both to set some things up, and it needs to then run it as it goes forward.
Right. Well, I took it from your prior going through the list in terms of choices that people have to make, that you were focusing on formation. I think that's a very different context from what a company that's been formed needs in order to keep operating and make its day-to-day kinds of decisions, if you will.
So one of the things then, one of the functionalities then is also has to be an updating functionality in a sense.
Well, yes, it's so. I mean, I guess what you're saying is you have to allow the amendment to the company agreement. I guess maybe you do or maybe you don't, but that's not the same as enabling people to work together in a day-to-day context where the tasks are not at the level where you would write them into an operating agreement, but they are more at the level of who's going to do what and who's going to write that check and who's going to sign that agreement.
Okay.
Anyway, I don't mean to take you off track here. I'm going back on mute and listen to see what happens.
Okay. This is for those who haven't met John Clippinger, this is John Clippinger.
Thank you. Sorry to be late.
It's okay.
Park in another time zone.
John's parking spot is closer to downtown Boston than it is to here. But
I get Harvard ranks, right?
You get Harvard ranks. So, John, we've been working our way through. We're kind of down into the topics question here, and we're working off of Peter's. David is in the
David
sky.
David is here. David, hello.
Hey, John.
And we've been working our way through. In here is Peter's. Not that one so much as this is his generic questionnaire for clients on an operating agreement.
Oh, excellent!
And we've seen the exit strategy. He had also laid out these kinds of four basic. He views it as four basic questions. What business is it in? Capital, but it's really a question of marrying activities and resources, sharing benefits.
Governance and exits, yeah.
Governance and exits. Yeah. And in his questionnaire here, we've been through the first article is about some of the exit aspects, adding in dispute resolution, and then voting and governance issues. Cool. Urs had also put on the table the notion that thinking backwards from where the disputes happen into this is also a useful lens to bring to it all. If we go back into this notion that we have this question of put, you know, what is the authority to act either in internally in terms of routinizing, as David says, the day-to-day, you know, what is it day-to-day people are going to be doing? There's a coordination function. Ooh, there's a coordination function that goes with this as well. So decision-making is not just about this kind of authority to the outside, right, but it's also who is delegated authority to be the coordinating agent, in a sense, if I can put it in that framework. But we've got a set of decisions then that need to happen, and at least part of what we've been thinking is that we can pop into that slot of decisions some kind of mechanism for making those decisions happen, whether that mechanism is a voting mechanism, a dictatorial mechanism, subgroup that gets to vote, all of that kind of thing tied back into some of the roles that we get. But at least, is it fair to think of it in terms of at the end of some kind of process of polling, dictating whatever it is, we then have an authority to make the next step? Yeah.
especially at the risk of not talking past the non-lawyers or talking past the non-lawyers, can I propose a metaphor for this?
Sure.
Thinking of the corporation, a legal person, as an avatar or something from the world of like online gaming, where you have these creatures that can do different things, and the members, the stakeholders in the company are, it's an avatar that's run by a committee. And you can alternately, you can poll all the members, you can take a vote, you can randomly select a portion of the members every time it's your avatar, your character's time to move, your company's time to move. You can randomly select one person who makes a decision, you can select a subset of the members, you can poll all of them, or you can do any number of other things that could be decided later. But that's, I think, a good framework or metaphor for non-lawyers to maybe get their head around this idea of the legal person being run by several people.
Okay, that a helpful. Okay. So and again, some ways the question is where does that where does that end up situating itself, and how do we do that? But is it fair to say that that's at least one of our topics that we want to make sure would be covered would be how that set of functionalities works, is a set of deciding functionalities that go forward. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of just speaking of the avatar sort of a metaphor, the idea, at least the way I usually try to think of these things, is that there may be some centralization of who is authorized to act, and that would be done through the operating agreement. Some things would basically have a more limited group that gets the vote on them, and other things would have a more broad sort of group that would vote on those, more bigger decisions. I mean, if it's a major, the way we typically structure them, if it's a big decision, you have to go back to everybody. If it's a subset of decisions which are not as big, sort of more day-to-day managerial things, mm-hmm. typically the operating agreement would try to sort of delegate those things to a group of people who then would be able to act on its behalf without having to continually go back to the big group. And so, you know, in terms of the tripwires for different actions you described, Oliver, that would be sort of the way it would often be set up. You know, some group of, and actually we've seen it in discussing in the virtual company context, there's been some discussion with people, the founders of the enterprise, so to speak, want to retain some ability to sort of do some things in terms of managing it, in terms of entering into contracts necessary to set it up, some things that need to happen in order for it to exist and get going, that they don't necessarily want to go back to the members on. But then if there are other things that are more fundamental to the enterprise that get beyond that sort of narrow sphere, you go back to the members, and that would be the tripwire for that.
So one piece of this then is important, that from a functionality standpoint, is to be able to differentiate between different groupings and different, whether it's particularly as we scale things up, to be able to differentiate between what's a classic kind of executive or directive, right, or whatever it is, an inner group versus a less involved group.
Yeah, now the thing, and David had mentioned this before, I mean, where we were, and this is sort of goes back to sort of, if we're going to a more generic model, or just going to what we he and I had thought of in terms of the virtual company context model. In the virtual model, as he's described, I think he and I were thinking that we would typically allow a great deal of flexibility in the operating agreement, and then have that developed by different groups of people who come together in these companies as they operate after the operating agreement is set up. Versus having to try to, in a more generic model, trying to specify a lot of that stuff in the operating agreement itself, which would be the more classic way to do it. But we're not convinced that in the virtual world it makes as much sense.
So, but
Oliver, I agree with that. I just want to point out that just so far as the main thing that's been demonstrated to be different about the event is that there's, in peer production, there's an opportunity for people to self-select for different roles. So if you view creation of the entity as just a collective appropriation of the fruit of peer production, it is not the case that every decision has to be delegated to some manager. It could be that the company allocates resources by virtue of the fact that the participants allocate themselves in the different roles.
I agree. fully that that's a vision that we should be able to implement. But again, is that an internal widget to this kind of coordination function from the bottom up versus the top down, or does it require a different architecture altogether?
In my own view, it's an essential feature of any online software instantiation of this kind of thing, that it enables a group of people who are coming together to see what roles they're playing and see themselves in relationship to the activity of the company as a whole. That's not exactly the same thing as choosing an operating agreement. But it is, to my mind, the one thing that is fundamentally missing in terms of the software support for this kind of online organization. You have to be able to see what's going on. You have to see what role you're playing, what you're responsible to do, what others are doing. That's not a subject that the operating agreement can deal with, but it is the essence of what the screen can do as a content.
So actually, yes, David, what you're suggesting is another kind of functionality which we could have here, which we can't have in many other kinds of circumstance, which is a sort of auto-updating, as it were, of the condition of the company, of the condition of who's doing what, you know, all of that kind of thing. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
David, just a clarification. Would you see that if people can self-select what they want to do, are they choosing from a menu of pre-described roles, or are they going to define their own role?
Well, I think that's either one of those things is possible. You obviously want to enable the participants to create new roles, because that's what's going to be necessary for the entity to adapt to the external world. How you constrain that, whether you require, you know, a quality control layer that says a new role has to be proposed or the occupant of the role has to be approved by some process, those are all variations that I think are possible, but again, not necessarily something you would write into the formal, legally binding operating agreement as opposed to working right out over time.
Jim Moore has joined us. Jim, I have pre-introduced you, and we are in the midst of a talking through the kind of topic list Peter, if you would pass that down to Jim.
Hey, how are you, Peter?
Good, how are you?
Working our way through what are some of the requirements for this? What is the insight that's new to me? I must admit, out of this conversation, is this coordination function. I've been thinking in terms of, as a lawyer, I've been thinking in terms of authority and all that kind of things. But as is being said, there is this kind of coordination function, and whether it's self-coordinating or semi-self-coordinating or dictator coordinating, you know, that's something I'm gonna need to work at. But I think it is clearly one of the roles that we've got to figure out how this digital format will work with.
I really like this discussion, and I think it's a crucial aspect. And I'm really interested in Peter's and David's thoughts on that, because I think it also nicely reflects a big problem that we have with our existing laws and as the way they, you know, structure actually the institution, which is the company, right? In our case here, I think it's very difficult to find the appropriate legal equivalent to, say, Wikipedia. If you think of Wikipedia as an organization, which could be a company, not for profit, but let's assume it could be what we here discuss as a company, which is more an organization, right? How can you, what would be kind of the legal setup, the appropriate legal setup for Wikipedia? If you think of it as this collaborative space, you have platform providers, but you have basically this peer production going on. I think we are not very well equipped from the legal side to frame that appropriately. Is it kind of a network of contracts? Is it what is the type of relationship between the different parties? And especially when we want to make it more stable, or when we want to, you know, think of it as a commercial entity. Then I think you see this difficulty that we have a problem with our legal instruments. And now, in a way, to me, this discussion here reflects some of this tension that we see in other fields as well, where, you know, multiple entities are starting to work together. You have different types of division of labor, capital flows, you know, kind of trust relationships that come into play and are much more important, where actually information flow determines the governance structure and not actually what is written in the agreement, but the actual interactions are kind of creating the norms, how a company runs. And so I think this is, as a design question, it's a very important one. On the one hand side, it's clear to me, and I think that's the way you framed the discussion for today, that we have some core set of legal functionalities and legal requirements that we need to take into account when talking about the virtual company. And that's also very helpful, your questionnaire and all kind of stuff, right? That provides almost like a minimum requirements that actually we have something like a company in the legal sense. But now, the big question, of course, that we're discussing right now, what happens if you look more at the phenomenon, what's going on in the online space when it comes to organizations and the structure of organizations? And there seems to be some incompatibility, actually, right? And probably our big chance is, and that's where I really like your statement, Oliver, that you say, probably we have to be more creative how we envision the governance of this organization, the governance structure, and take into account social norms and all the kind of stuff, you know, we've doing in our labs, and to understand what enables cooperation and collaboration and how is that managed well, right? And what's the role of software? Are the appropriate platforms and so forth. And then in the third step, to understand, like, how can we bring the two things together? So, like, the basic legal requirements and the basic legal infrastructure that needs to be in place, and the more kind of softer, non-legal, more code-based, more, you know, also social norm-based elements, and create this virtual company infrastructure, basically. So I think that's not an easy task, but in a way, I think we need to approach it from both sides. So,
yeah.
And that's what I see what happens today, which I like
back,
a lot.
To go back to your point, though, about legal incompatibility, that actually one of the gorgeous things about the limited liability company is that with only five or six exceptions, you can agree to almost anything as its modus operandi from a legal standpoint. And that you can contract into all kinds of variations, including, you know, if the decision authorization is X or Y.
I agree, absolutely. Yeah. But my understanding is that it's even hard to tell whether a collaborative effort, an organization that is so dynamic as a phenomenon in the cyberspace,
right,
would count as a company. So, you know, I agree with you. Once we agree we have a company here.
Okay.
Then, you know, I agree, I have some flexibility. But what we see happening right now seems to me is questionable. Is this highly dynamic set of collaborators and changing institutions, different grades?
Yeah, this is a clarification, because I think what you're getting at is when you said that the coordination function becomes a kind of governance function. And though it's informal, it has sort of formal implications. And as when things become digital, it becomes more explicit. Actually, it's something that becomes manageable. So who gets notifications at what point in time? And you could have some of that be algorithmic, but it has lots of implications that are not just coordination, but actually management governance. And there's a bleeding here, and so how that's structured becomes actually quite important. It's the character of what it is, and as to the governance, okay. Whereas it's less explicit in the offline world. But here, it's you have a digital signature of everything you do, right?
Okay.
No, I take your point. I take your point, and so part of it is figuring out when do you need people like Peter and me, and when don't you need people like Peter and me, and when do we provide?
We're trying to minimize that.
Well,
no.
When do you provide? But when do we provide the service? The service that the lawyers have traditionally provided is wrapping a set of reliable expectations around these right. interchanges, particularly when we get into you know major commitments of resources, major commitments of time, major commitments of money. You know all of these things which are That's you know that before we take the major step, we want to know where our wraparound is. And what you're suggesting is there are plenty of cases where we don't have that wraparound, but when we when we want to invoke the law.
No, my question, that's actually why I like this idea of a host company so much that you described as on the paper and you were, because that provides this sort of functionality and services. You know, if you need it, you can get it there, and you're pretty flexible. But I think the question is more, I think lawyers will always be important. My question is, I guess, whether the structures that we have in place, which basically replicate what we know from the offline world and now transfer into the digital mm-hmm. world and have, of course, lower transaction costs and many advantages, I clearly see that, whether this is actually, as a matter of format, really the thing we want to get and want to see online in order to enable these new forms, the third way of...
Right.
Production of things, right?
And
services
right.
and so
we're just taking the offline world, we're putting it in inline.
Is that
right?
And if not, which is my working hypothesis, it's not perfectly the adequate tool set. What other piece could we add in terms of governance structures or enabling governance structures that would help us to enable this new form of collaborative initiatives and things that may or may not be a company as you describe it? As of today.
Right.
So it's a real question. It's not.
Is David still on the phone?
David, you back?
Yeah, I'm back. I dropped off for a minute.
It would seem that would
be
David's
yeah.
specialty, I think, is this
yeah,
sort
yeah.
of, right, David?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure what the question is.
Well, the question is, I know you've been bouncing in and out of hearing, but Urs gave just gave an impassioned and a plea for not getting hidebound into the old ways and actually viewing the possibilities of peer production as defining where we're headed rather than where the law has been as where we're headed.
Well, I certainly agree with that, and in my view, the key question is how do you take the kind of self-selecting, voluntary kinds of activities that peer production currently demonstrates and enable the contributors to collectively control what they produce. That's the missing piece of the picture from my perspective, and one that might conceivably incentivize the even more productivity of that type.
Yes, because the alternative to some of this we're seeing in things like Mechanical Turk. Now, we're making some very good use of Mechanical Turk in the Law Lab, but Mechanical Turk is a means by which you can parse work out into cyberspace and then recapture essentially all the upside for the parser outer. It becomes a form of assigning tasks and having people agree. It's basically an online labor market, but it's an online labor market in the earliest 19th century kind of piecework format. Yeah. And so what you end up with is essentially the ability of a centralized person, a corporate or individual, to exploit the labor of others without them then having the benefits of being a co-owner. And at least one of the reasons to think about an LLC or other ownership style structure for these collaborative interactions in the web is that you actually then with any benefit allow people to have the benefit of the upside. They have little slices of the upside in ways that transforms them from a Marxian wage slave to a potential owner as well.
Right. I just want to point out that most of the existing legal corporate forms have traditionally been driven by the need to coordinate the sharing of capital. And so what peer production does is open the possibility of sharing attention and effort without even needing to share capital to sort of entity. And that's the essence of what the operating agreement is meant to do.
Yes, is what we've sometimes been talking about here is post-capitalist free enterprise. What happens when people are able to have the benefits of economic choice about their own activities, but where you can assemble large-scale production platforms that don't require lots and lots of money as their upfront. You know, it's almost like a monster sweat equity machine. What does that do? Now, obviously, there are places that'll work. There are other places it won't. I'm not sure you can build a hotel through peer-to-peer production. You know, and the actual construction of a hotel may be hard to do. Running a hotel, you might be able to, but I think that building it may require classical forms of capital. But certainly there are other activities like the software world and the Wikipedia kind of world and the peer-to-peer knowledge production and all that great stuff that may not require any of this. The other model, by the way, besides Wikipedia, is Facebook. You know, why isn't Facebook owned by its participants? You know, instead of having to fight with some group that decides it's going to own all your intellectual property next week, why isn't it a collaborative?
They may be about to find out that they are.
No, I think that's one of the real appeals of this is that you're going to be able to create mashups in a cloud and people declare their own governance agreements and then share their and it will be something like that. That's where this is going
to
go.
But let me come back around to the other side, though, which is Peter's questionnaire. Because as Peter says, people mashing up don't necessarily figure out the issues that they're going to face going forward. If you take Urs's backwards view, you know, what are they going to have a fight over 2 years from now that we can actually specify some rules about now if experts right. in what games have to be constructed around can help. So if we have a framework within which the code can specify in a transparent way what's going to happen when the inevitable dust-ups occur, then presumably we're much better off, and those organizations will have a stability and a longevity that will be different from if they blew up and then they all just either fought or they had to go to court in some inchoate way in some jurisdiction they didn't anticipate to try right. and figure out, you know, somebody to settle it for them from the outside. That fair enough? I think I'm trying to keep a role for us, Peter, in this. You know,
that's one thing. I'll abrogate my role, walk out. I think one of the fundamental things, though, I'm thinking about my questionnaire and the generic questionnaire is I don't know whether our time isn't better spent sort of focusing on what sort of the backup role is sort of the idea. The question is sort of what role in terms of should the operating agreement play as compared to subsequent decisions being made by participants in the enterprise? Should the operating agreement sort of set up this be another sort of preliminary sort of framework within which people can do peer production, can evaluate how they're going to share their economics and all that sort of stuff? And that's really what I think David and I have sort of, that's the direction we were going down, rather than trying to in the classic sense, anticipate a lot of this stuff in the agreement itself and define it all in the agreement itself. And so, in terms of my questionnaire, I don't know whether, it covers everything in a classic sense you would want to have in an operating agreement. I'm not sure, though, it's really the relevant direction in terms of, in the virtual company sphere versus maybe looking sort of at what we've come up with in terms of the operating agreement, a form of operating agreement, and starting from there in terms of something that allows subsequent decisions to be made.
Well, again, some operating agreements can be blueprints for evolution, and some can be very tightly bound.
Right.
And we can do that currently. Right. Part of it is whether it's like a constitution for a country. You can write in prohibition, or you can write in a means by which people can decide whether they can sell alcohol or not.
Right.
So I would view the open constitution format as being a good one. But again, if it's completely open, then we're back to square one where people are kind of groping around and nobody knows what if who owns what and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
What is it? But again, to come back a little bit. I don't mean to be tied endlessly to your format here, but I think it's a useful thing to kind of say what do we need about that? What list of things would we try and have in a, whether it's a dictatorial model or a predictated model or an evolving constitution model? What are these primitives? What are these abstractions that we need to get at to as we program around these things? I know that's a big question. Do we want one of the things that presumably we want to have is something that, and John, I know this is something you've talked about, something that relates to identity. I mean, one of the primitives presumably is actually just identifying players. Is that fair to say that would some kind of free floating anonymity be?
Well, I mean, I have a view on this. I mean, and that is, I think you can have authenticated anonymity. You can have a lot of things, but at some point you're going to have some kind of persistent identifier that's linked to certain permissions and roles. If you're going to have classes of members, then do people have those kind of participation rights and things? So I think in my view, the underlying mechanisms for that are quite important, because if you don't design that correctly, then you're going to inhibit how you can evolve this thing.
Okay. So in a classic company, you got shareholders, you got directors, you've got members of the, you've got some kind of identified player. Is that something that's going to persist in this world, both in terms of the traditional and going forward? David, would you see a world in which we did not have identified players, that identity didn't matter and anybody could come in and just do whatever and that would be fine? I mean,
well, no, obviously you have to have persistent identity. It's the question of whether anyone can come in is a different question. You may have a situation where anyone can come in, but they only become entitled to participate in the decision making or in the proceeds. But when they are, their contribution is valued by somebody, or they pass some other level. And obviously, in order to make any payment of any money out of any system, you need a real world.
But also, voting in any gaming of voting and allocation, revocation of rights, participation in a notification process, all those things.
Let me explain how we got to where we are in the current draft operating agreement that we're working on. If you take away the organizing entity around capital, so you no longer have a presumptive duty of the board to shareholders, and you no longer have a presumptive managerial control from the top down, the major obvious other alternative is to say that people are going to have horizontally among themselves share whatever rights they are, whether or not decision-making or participation in that proceeds. And then obviously in the context of a value-producing enterprise, in proportion to their view of each other's contribution. So that's what drove us in the direction of starting from the atom that everybody who's been valued as a contributor gets to value everyone else's contribution.
But that, David, I mean, we've talked about this before. I mean, there's something called smartocracies and how you give. And if I understand what you're saying, then people are willing to allocate sort of proxy votes to different people based upon their levels of participation. Is this or how they're viewed within the community?
Right. You then have the transaction cost problem, and you have to make it possible for people to delegate to proxies who agree with their view on those questions. But that's a different question from the original one, which is say everyone's as entitled at the outset.
No, I understand that.
Right.
Okay. So, trying to think Asian of abstractions person. And primitives. Identity is one. I think that's fair to say that we got to have a system that's going to track identity, and that identity will be then a locus of some of these other attributes as well. That we're able to localize whether it's permissions, roles, rights.
And the entity itself can have an identity. So it can be a person. So you know.
Yes, which is
so. So and it can have all sorts of attributes that are assigned to it, and then I'm thinking about a multi-agent simulation. So, I've got my own view.
Okay.
But I think then you have relations between different parties.
Okay.
That, in a sense, and you have a grammar of relationships that in effect are acceptable relationships. And then you have conditions and constraints on that. And if you do that, then you can model this in a genetic algorithm. But anyway,
that's jumping to a solid conclusion. There we go. So we're going to have a set of identities, which will be one key element in this thing, and the attributes of identity will be at least one possible way of defining how many of these other topics work. I mean, for instance, the governance one can be tied into a set of identity. Possibilities and then summations of identity and who did what and that kind of thing.
I think you're looking like a kind of, we talked about this a while ago, so there's like a backbone framework that you're as a bus, there's something you're going to hang things off of.
Right.
And so identity is one component of it, but there are other kind of mechanisms, the notification delegation mechanisms or balloting mechanisms that you could fill in. I mean, it's like you're binding a variable. You can think of them in instantiation in a particular way, but there's a certain sort of finite subset of those mechanisms that you need in order to have a functioning organization, right, or a corporation.
Right.
So, you know, and so you can make lots of choices around it, but I think in order for this to work, we would have to sort of understand bound what those are. I mean, so you can have a mechanism for dispute resolution, you can have a mechanism for notification or delegation, and there may be different ways of doing that, right?
Yeah. Okay. No, exactly. I'm trying to figure out what do we need to make sure that what functionalities we build into to all this. So identity, delegation, notification, information is kind of a sphere again, in under what at a high level might be some of a decision or management label.
But I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's being done. It's like business process models, and many aren't. And we part talking about that. You're saying, mm-hmm. Okay, what are the components of the business process models, and right. Then how do those get instantiated and realized under different kinds of agreements? And so we're really trying to identify what those core processes are, from what I understand.
Yeah.
And the other thing I just want to make sure or revisit again is that we were sort of talking in a sense that this management structure, this thing is entirely flat. There's no real, at least the way.
No, the virtual company. Your
virtual
company.
And from the real world, at least my limited interaction with people who are interested in doing this in the real world, I haven't had a single person who wants a totally flat.
Well, I was going to get to that. Do you really? Yeah. I mean, can you really have a toy? Because even the way David described it, there were certain layers that seemed to be, because you would take someone in off the street, but they don't get privileges until they're told that they have. You know, it's right. It's sort of. It's Animal Farm, you know, where some are more equal than others.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that has certain implications because, and you're going to have some kind of emergent hierarchy based upon certain criteria that are acceptable to the group.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
Okay. Oh, okay. There's Mr. Flat.
I do think. The essence of what makes an entity is its ability to self-repair and to have organizational goals. And those things really tie to how you allocate a mutually reinforcing set of jobs, if you will, to the people who are working for the enterprise. So that's not the same thing as identity. It's really figuring out how to make sure that there's a minimum critical mass of interacting roles that produce value at a level that keeps the entity viable.
Could you elaborate on examples in this instance of what do you mean by self-repair?
Well, I mean, in the simple cases, when somebody who is supposed to make the cupcakes goes missing, you have to get someone else to make the cupcakes. You know?
Oh, okay. Well,
So self-repairing from the standpoint of the operations of the company, in a sense, not in terms of the
entity itself,
or in terms of the kind of a rule base for making decisions.
That's a really important point. Yeah. Because if you think of the entity as having its own identity, then by self-repair you mean at that level. But when you first said it, I thought you were thinking about as a member. That they were self-repairing members, and so you just designed it that way.
I'm saying that an entity is a social organism. It has a metabolism, and when it and everything in any system wears out or disappears at some point, and you have to have a mechanism for replacing it.
Right. Okay. Got it.
The
Rosen principle, right?
But at least a,
right.
A piece then that is a question for us is because again, as from a lawyer standpoint, you know, the topics that we have often we were brought in at the drafting the Constitution kind of level, if it's fair to say that our job is to really draft the constitutions for businesses and for entities and for these kinds of collaborations rather than the actual role assignment thing, which then occurs within the procedures of the Constitution. And what I think you're suggesting and I'm hearing is that we've got to, in this, to make the full thing possible, we've got to merge those two a bit. And have both a management as the day to day has to be in the system as well as the kind of constitutional aspects of it as well. All right.
Yeah.
That makes it harder. We'll figure it out.
It's partly because the question isn't just how you create a legal entity that is suited to Wikipedia. How you do that in a context in which the entity is going to be reasonably likely to be able to make commitments to other parties, customers, and suppliers, and so forth.
Yeah, there is then again that question of the external commitments and the authority to act with respect to the outside world.
That's right.
Yeah, because we see that what peer production now does is it works on projects where.
Yeah.
Being able to make a commitment is not essential, and the amount of time it takes for the online group to do its thing is not of the essence. What's missing is the ability for, not that every virtual company will necessarily succeed, but to create something where there's enough persistence and reliability to the way the thing operates that it can create more value than a mob.
Now, here's a question, as I've been thinking about this on exactly this point, which is, to what degree would we want the software to be self-authorizing, and in other words, would we want if the software got everybody together and they had a vote that they were going to do X with the money, would that be enough, and that the bank would automatically do X with the money, or do you want a treasurer who then talks to the bank and says, "Bank, do X. I've been authorized to do this." Do we want to have a person, is there a useful cross-check from the person in the role, or do we just want to move it straight into the software?
That's an identifiable function that you can fill in algorithmic or by a person. That should be, but at least you have to identify the function.
And the function is to act as triggers to the outside world.
But it could be totally automated. I mean,
it can be totally automated, and there are
operating agreement function.
It could be indeed, and the question is that, and when we get to that stage functionality, the question is what is the necessary permission to do X with the bank, and the necessary permission could be the software says so. It could be the software will inform the treasurer, who will then say so.
Well, there's a difference between an officer in the traditional corporate sense and an agent, and where. Thinking about this issue has pushed us is to say the company can have any number of individuals explicitly authorized to be active agents, including agents for purposes of ordering the bank to make a payment. But that's different from having somebody with plenary power to play a particular kind of role in the company.
I hear what you're saying, David. But do we want to have? Is there a role for the human in this dealing with the outside world structure that we wanted?
But why is that important?
Well, just important as a design.
It's an option. It's a check.
It can be an option or check.
It's not a fundamental architectural issue. If we're looking at functionally in process, I don't think it is.
It is in the sense that
if for some purposes you want to identify the company acting together, however it makes decisions, wants to identify someone who's authorized to go out in the world and, sign a contract or do whatever, then there has to be a mechanism for people to see that that's what's going on and to see who is playing that role.
Right.
And that's needed internally and externally, actually.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I'm just saying how that's implemented is open.
sure.
Yeah. I'd like to go back to something, David, that we were getting at a minute ago. And I think that's the difference between, it seems to me there are two classes of relationships to the outside world. One of them is things like releasing payments and so forth like that, where there's no question about your ability to actually do it, okay? And then there's other things where there's tremendous question about your ability to actually do it, like when you enter into a contract to produce something in the future. And it seems to me that's a major distinction here, and I think that is not one that's well satisfied right now in the peer production world. And so, for example, the reason people were willing to buy from Red Hat initially was because Intel backed the company. And the reason people currently use a lot of open source software is because IBM backs it. And so, you know, and even Wikipedia, okay, people didn't rely on it until it existed. And even now, Wikipedia actually does require a tremendous amount of capital for servers, a tremendous amount. So there's a, currently these organizations are backstopped by very, very large conventional entities, whether foundations or wealthy individuals or huge corporations. And this issue of reliability is also the flip side of liability, okay? I mean, the whole issue of the limited liability corporation, right, is that, you know, we're gonna take some risk here. We're gonna do something. We're gonna make some commitments. We may not be able to actually achieve that, and if so, we want to limit the downside liability here. We're not actually committing beyond a certain point. So I think in there there's a lot of stuff here. And David, I think that was that seemed to be part of where you were going. And I agree
with everything you just said. I mean, the consequence, I think, is that where the entity involves pooling time and attention, obviously the people who are doing that are taking a risk with their own time and effort that the other people will deliver and show up. So one of the software requirements is that you should have a reputational system so you can tell who's signing up and whether enough people have signed up and whether you should really join this company based on who's with it, so forth.
Okay, so David, just to reinforce that, so a key component of sort of on the bus, they're going to have the on the enterprise bus, is they have a reputation system, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I'm just reinforcing that. Now, how it gets implemented, you know, yeah. I mean, it's going to be...
No, clearly, again, I mean, if you think about that now, right. That's how these projects work, yeah, right? No, I mean, if there are people with stellar reputations that you either want to work with them, or you want to, or you believe they will deliver even if somebody else doesn't, then you're willing to sign up.
And that becomes the basis of which you're able to make external commitments based upon the reputations of internal actors.
Yeah, well, that's the other piece of it. I mean, David was saying that there's the piece when I come in as a participant, you know, is this something I want to come into? And then the other side of this is if I'm an external party that's going to rely on this software, you know, or whatever, to what extent am I willing to do that? You know, and back to the bank, you know, it's one thing to have a bank account. It's another thing for the bank to loan you money for servers, you know, or Cisco to loan you money for infrastructure.
No, I take your point, and that a Wikipedia or a Facebook actually both have relatively defined fields of what they're doing, and those fields don't typically, I mean, you know, you set up the system, you let it play, its benefits come from its play, there may be some bits and pieces of the outside, but you're not then contracting, as you say, into the future. For Wikipedia doesn't agree to provide IBM with a system of information management.
Right.
And that ability to commit into the future is an interesting, somewhat different relation to the outside world than simply being an authorized agent of the kind that
right. And David had said early on, David, I want to remind you of something you said to me about how you had this sort of practical problem of in open source groups, how do you keep the groups together when it gets hard? You know, like it's one thing when people are just like really YouTube is not something that, you know, requires a lot of hard work on behalf of the people putting videos up there. But a serious software project, like if someone were building the platform together for YouTube, that's a serious hard commitment. And currently, by the way, that's done by capital. I mean, that's they're not using a platform that's peer produced.
Right.
Well, consider an alternative. One type of virtual company might be a group that comes together to build a specialized wiki for a customer. And the risk that the customer takes can be mitigated by having them pay only on delivery, if you will. That, there may be other some risks, but the point is that managing the risk of the customer is easier than making sure you have enough people come together to get the job done in a time that's better than trigger the customer's payment.
Which is partly why current online work allocation systems are often contests and things like that, because they basically are saying only on delivery, you know.
But Jim, I think you're getting at another point when you brought up Red Hat. We had this conversation before is because in effect you have a lot of stuff that's developed in an open source world that there are issues of liability and licensing questions that people do not want to take on and say in a corporate enterprise unless some other third party is going to be behind them, and they assume that risk. So you have some of your Red Hat, this kind of entity in effect is can make certain kind of assurances about certain collective products.
Yeah, that's right.
Given
yeah.
a method that can manage that risk in a way that's acceptable to a third party.
Yeah, the interesting thing is I was analyzing Red Hat's financials and I was analyzing Red Hat's organization, the whole system, its ecosystem, not Red Hat the company per se. And what was fascinating to me first was that the gross margins in Red Hat are the margins not of a service provider, but of a software company. They're, 80-90% gross margins. Okay. Most of their revenues comes from they call them subscriptions, and they make a big deal how those are not licenses, but effectively they are. But what they sell is they sell this kind of guarantee. I mean, they sell we'll support this for 7 years. They sell that they will protect you from intellectual property, lawsuits. They sell you not exactly support by the hour, but they sell you the guarantee that somewhere in their community you can get support. So basically, if you want to talk about this third way from what's happening out there right now, Red Hat is an entity, a very, very profitable entity, that sits between the communities. Okay, so upstream they have this thing Herzog or something, which is their advanced technology thing. Upstream of that, they've got several hundred open source projects. They have this whole thing about driving the innovation upstream into those open source projects. They take them down into Herzog or whatever it's called, and by the time they get down into Herzog, they actually work. Okay.
Who's running Red Hat and how is it run? Is it
It's a private company.
No, I'm sorry,
it's a public company. It's a conventional public company.
And
it was originally backed by Intel Capital. I mean, it's a.
Greylock's on the board. They're kind of build kind of, but they had $400 million last profit was the last quarter, was it?
Let me break it out for you. Instead of you guess, but they over the last last three quarters. They did about, I think it's 480 or something million of subscription or license revenues, okay, with a cost of about 50 million or something, okay. And then they did, I mean, you can go there and get the financials from Yahoo, but then they did about, I think the number's about 80 million of sort of training revenues, they call it, and with the cost of goods of about 55 million or something. So, my point is this is a very conventional, in a sense, intellectual property certification company, okay? That
even if his claim is that that's not what we're doing,
exactly.
But that is what they do, and that's why they're the leading, as they say, the leading open source company. Well, they're the leading intermediary. They're the leading trusted liability holding intermediary between open source communities
on peer production
selling it to. To large companies.
That's an interesting twist.
That is a very interesting. I think about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I just have an interesting thing that I've been listening to that you were talking about reputation, but realistically what you're talking about is trust. I mean, Red Hat, you're paying Red Hat for trust. You're paying them to since there's not any known players in the open source market, since everyone's sort of writing their own code and it's being developed in a cloud, per se. Like, the cloud has no
you grasp a cloud, it's a thing, but you can't really, there's nothing that you can get in it. It's particulate, to be metaphorical. You're paying Red Hat for the trust. So if you have something here where you have, what's it called? Attack-resistant trust metrics is, I think, one of the things that someone's actually working on right now. Where you have sort of the ability to, and since one of the things that you're doing is trying to have this identity role in it, the open source becomes trustworthy. It becomes a known player.
Yep.
And if you can assign, in a way, an automated trust metric to it,
which is like
you get, beyond just the authority, beyond just the identity, because
I see where you're going. Yeah.
Because that's the identity is,
no,
is
just an aspect,
the foundation of it. I mean, you would wouldn't be able to accrue trust if you didn't have the identity locked.
But you're authenticating certain claims that a person makes about themselves by an independent party that cannot be attacked or gained.
Well, if you look at reputation and trust, like the reputation model in Wikipedia, when you look at it, all the people that are in there contributing to it, they don't have they have no model where you can rate the trust of of a person. Even though that person has made thousands of edits, you go in there and you go to that person's page and the reputation is defined by the person itself. It's not defined by the trust of the people looking at the entry, which is very different from the idea of you go in and you write code and your trust is defined by the people who use your code the people who have used your services and say that you are trustworthy.
We like this. It worked.
There are two different, I think there are two measurements where you look at this thing. So reputation is definitely one thing where you look at it and where it's anonymous, and trust is definitely one where you look at it where it's validated.
Stay 2 minutes.
What you're talking about here is you're talking about a big picture where IBM is a signatory on whatever, and Intel is a signatory.
Like
whatever,
an insurer or something.
Yeah. You underwrite the risk.
AIG did this.
And if you have it where the members actually sort of achieve this trust, and you have some sort of backing authority like the law or the whatever, the I-cards or whatever. Yeah. Then you have sort of a trust model that's built on itself. And if you have good metrics that then can evaluate people that aren't gameable.
That
are very attack resistant, you can achieve this trust without having these corporations in the back end. And having this, I think, being extensible, plugged into this whole thing where you have a digital corporation is, I think, a good idea.
Let me stop us for a moment. We're about to lose Lydia to Seattle, but before she goes, I wanted to make sure she had a moment or two to share her thoughts at this point.
Right. Well, let me just tell you all a little bit about what my project is, because it might be relevant, probably not now, but down the line. So I'm in MIT's computer science program and getting my master's now and then PhD. But I do usability, trying to write very usable software, in particular trying to write applications for people who are not programmers, but the end product of their interaction is a program. So right now I've been working with economists, and they want to be able to have games played online, like Prisoner's Dilemma, Rock, Paper, Scissors, simple things and complex things, but they want to be able to author those interfaces. At some point. So now that they have a sense of how these games generally go, they just want to say, okay, I need this screen, this decision, and this is how the payoffs are going to work. So I sort of write that translation from here are the overarching set of rules to here now you have a game that can be played. So at some point, the virtual law may be interested in an environment where lawyers and other people who aren't programmers, or even programmers who just don't want to reinvent the wheel every time, can specify some rules and then have an interface generated for them, and in the most usable way possible. I mean, that's where I come in. Probably down the line.
Well, I think you're actually describing what is hopefully about 3 months away, at least at some kind of prototypical phase, where we will indeed be able to have something that looks exactly that does that Peter Early could go to with the client, or that the client could go to by themselves, or whatever, and check some boxes. In a sense, his questionnaire is that already. in a written form. That these are the boxes that would be then presumably be checked as it went forward. And then, you know, that would be backed up if we were doing a more traditional style company. That would be backed up then by a set of functions that would be programmed in to manage, you know, the decisions taken here. Even if we go to the bigger kind of wiki style company, presumably there's going to be some of that. The initial person who sets it up is going to at least check a bunch of boxes, and then if it as it self manages and grows going forward, again there will be interfaces that do that as well. So the question of what that interrelationship looks like is critical.
Yeah, so where you say, you know, check a bunch of boxes, there are more complicated things that you could do, and that's sort of where I come in.
Okay.
I am very happy to have you think about it as checking a bunch of boxes, because it's a problem for somebody else. But it's not entirely easy. There are subtleties.
Well, no, but I mean, again, it would be great to hear, just if you've got another minute or two. I don't want you to keep you from your airplane, but what should we be thinking about? As you say, I've been thinking far too simplistically. What's the next?
Well, you have to think about when... So, I mean... So a large level idea that we have in my field is when people want to enter data, you can either do it sort of a very procedurally. I want X, Y, and it has to be in an order. We call that a wizard. And I guess anyone who's used software, you know, templates and PowerPoint, wherever you check through things. So that's one specific workflow. Another is to let people sort of access those options in any order that they want. Some people want to work backwards, and it depends on how different groups think. So, I mean, that's just one very large distinction between how you might want to actually gather the input from people trying to form a company.
And is there...
Can I make one comment? Because I think that what... Lydia and we met the other day, and I was really, we had longer to hear from her, and what I thought was so fascinating is that they really are ethnographers or anthropologists, and kind of cognitive anthropologists of professional practice. Okay, so in some sense, what they'd like to do is understand, you know, in a way, Peter could be a model of somebody who's practicing. Okay, and they want to understand how people who practice think. You know, whether it's the lawyers, how they practice, or the open source software people forming companies, how they practice. You know, there's a real anthropological, ethnographic task here to understand how people think, and then to build interfaces that sync up with the representations people have natively. Is that?
That's true, yeah. So yeah. From studying economists, we found that they heavily rely on payoff matrices. So you say what the possible options are, and then dollar amounts. And that's what they really focus on. It's not the little stuff. It's not... the sequence of events and things like that. It's just that outcome. And so from studying different groups, you'll clearly see different things that you sort of hinge your design around.
Okay. So. And as you say, then it's important to think not only in terms of some kind of linearity of step A, step B, step C, but also how to bop back and forth between that as you go forward.
Right.
When I do my TurboTax, it asks me in a linear fashion, but it also gives me the chance to go back and redo and recircle.
Yeah, and those things are really important, so okay. The user can do or accomplish their tasks.
Again, I, as you can see, hopefully listening to us and with these comments, that we are in the process of I think some of the kinds of exercise that you and your group are interested in. And we would be very interested in continuing that conversation and hearing more and poaching your expertise where we may.
Indeed. Well, I've heard some really powerful ideas here, some of which I'd sort of maybe heard before, and some things are completely new. Mm-hmm. So I hope we can help in the future. And please invite me to anything you think I can benefit from.
Well, that's terrific.
Thank you.
Why don't we take a 10-minute break? I think we could all use a 10-minute break, but let's try and reconvene back here at 35 after the hour, if we can.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. 10-minute break, David?
Okay, thanks. See you then.
Just dial back in.
Right.
Sebastian, I think your point was really, I really liked it. And I thought it was one of the things that struck me is that in Wikipedia, there's not a lot of dependence between the writings. So you're not building huge long chains of dependency on somebody
Peter,
else's
besides
work.
Being both
but in software,
and
as you're
sort of
describing, it's a lot about I write some code, somebody else has to use it.
You see convergence,
there's
divergence.
Totally, you know, there's really a big opportunity there too.
Submergence.
Did that work for me?
Much more applied in my perspective than you guys are talking about in terms of way people are interacting. Although I think it's all true. I tend to be sort of.
Well, it's not true. I mean,
sort of down the weeds, trying to figure out. Okay, so in terms of requirements, you know, the agenda for the meeting today is sort of applying a lot of this discussion, putting it in the context of what we're trying to get.
Right. Right. Coming away actually with the notion that this isn't I think that group lead developing the architecture may not be the thing, but I'm coming away much better educated about what some of that architecture might look like, and I think that at least one of the things we might do is have a couple people try and bash out a draft coming out of something like this, and then you know take the next iteration is then bouncing that draft off of group people.
I think a lot of what you guys are talking about, and one of my points was earlier, was that a lot of it may not be in terms of what sort of how you want to reflect the understanding that we have in terms of credentials or you know allowing an agreement to sort of provides for you know people evaluating each other's reputations, you know, and sort of you know getting admission to the network to begin with and all those sorts of things. I mean, I don't know even though if that's an operating agreement thing, but I think it's an essential part.
I think that's that you have to fuse
it's not just an operating agreement. This becomes a new thing that we're creating.
And part of the question, actually, the operating agreement stuff, can one approach you could take would be to use the identity as the centerpiece.
If you had a big
identity matrix, one piece of it could be ability to vote.
And then the decision making essentially is a
function that then refers back to the identity, says who's got Class A. I mean,
the ICARs have been set up to do this.
But it'd be like saying there's Class A common and Class B common. And Class A, you know, anybody with Class A common next to their on their little identity page gets now to do what we've defined. So when we get to what the decision making is, one question is do we structure it referring back into these attributes?
Kind of wrong to a
classically, there's been a tendency to cluster the attribute of sharing with the attribute of voting with the attribute, you know, the share of stock is effectively, it clusters those all together in a simple way. But we can also have more complicated structures, you know, where losses are born differently from profits, differently from voting.
What I think is interesting,
you want to break it down to
primitives, is that it's,
and then you can recombine them.
I think there's always been an insurance function that capital pools play.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and that's important.
I think generally in our kind of everyday economics, we don't think much about that, right?
We think you need capital to buy stuff, but you also need a pool of capital to ensure stuff, to provide security.
I actually think
the weeds doing it, which is, you know, okay.
I think it's almost like two functions.
But if I told you, I've got this complicated decision and a capital structure, advise me on how to structure it.
So, and I do think it's interesting that over time,
if
you really contract people's performance and their reputations, and people are willing to put their reputations at stake,
I mean,
that's what a professional does, right? That's what a lawyer does, or a software person does, in their own small world.
Is to figure out how
if none of us deliver to somebody, we only keep our reputation by fixing it, right? And once in a while, we all screw up, and then we have to work all night.
But I still think there's a merge. There is a merge of the coordinate and the. It's a new thing we're talking about. I mean, so I think just having the separation, the operating agreement, in a way, is not.
Yeah,
old world view, and there's a new fusion that needs to be done, and that's a new kind. There are new processes that need to be.
I think that's part of the problem in doctors is that they hide their malpractice so much as a group.
And we want to do it simple, but
they all have big malpractice fees.
No,
they were better at reputation among themselves and throwing out the bad
ones.
Their malpractice costs.
I don't see my way to that. Actually, what we're talking about, I see my my weight to, you know, I don't.
That's traditional. No, lawyers probably are fine with exposing each other because it's
lawyers. We set
business,
it up, and we unbind it. One of the other questions is, you know, this question of what do you want to bind tightly, what do you want to unbind, you know, leave more emergent.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Classically, the law has been the stuff you want to bind tightly.
I think it's very helpful to take a concrete case as an example where you can think about this.
You had identity, a guaranteed identity. You could then establish a trust model on top of that identity.
Take one random open source software project where people
together produce code. For a project,
and let's assume this code at some point, you know, becomes commercially relevant, right? Get the service that someone provides, whatever it is. It's kind of a longer history. And now, let's ask, what is the appropriate enabling infrastructure, both in legal terms as well as in social norms terms
and a known member base.
Technology terms to enable something like
this. Oh, I see.
And that was an
actually to foster it, right? To make it easy that it happens.
And anyway, he did his PhD on it.
I think it's a very tricky question.
What's his name, Ralph?
Actually, it's interesting that it's this distinction of the operating agreement and what it's
Levian, you said?
I think it does sound like an essential function of the enterprise.
Yeah, anyway, yes, that's totally random.
Evaluating the open, you know, what contributions are to identifying members. Is there more sort of thought to sort of how you develop a reputation as a member,
Avogadro?
How you get trusted, what sort of rights you have,
like
sort of, you know, that's all a very interesting
Avogadro?
Piece of
not
it. Right? You're Avogadro. Right, it's a good Avogadro. Thing to do. Avogadro. But actually, I'm getting feedback
Avogadro.
Now from a few people
Avogadro.
Regarding...
Anyway, I'll send this to Caroline.
The operating
no, that's,
and the question
that's,
that we
that's really critical.
And
to
most
making something
people,
like
as I said before, don't like the idea of
a game of
yeah, so anyway,
flat thing. They want to have they want to have a group of people and someone runs it. They assign out tasks to people.
Right.
They'll pay for a task. You know, so it's like
in place so that
for it's the internal core.
Well, and the internal core looks much more like the
and depending on your trust level, the host would either be automatically moderated, automatically accepted, or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
That's true. That's true. That's very
right.
True.
And then when they posted to this forum, it was about the reputation. It was about testifying to somebody else or something.
Big contribution.
I don't know.
Get that together.
No.
It's already great. But this is. I think your approach that we start there. And then, you know, over time, start kind of to think more broadly. You know, how does
really interesting.
Yeah, that is, that's really, no, I think that's really fascinating. I mean, that would also be, like, it's funny, because the
and
same
I really
problem
sort of, two
of
goals.
How do you
one
trust
is,
people's
is,
work,
we,
if you will,
if we could just
or
make,
their collaboration,
make
how do you trust people's work in a collaborative
work.
Context? I mean,
in the digital
it's also
world,
true just
that
in
would
a regular
be a, that would be a
corporation.
You know,
I,
but it's not
I
mean, the end point.
Part
but,
of what's
but,
wrong
but
with regular corporations is they have thousands of workers,
is,
you know, and they have no idea, you know, like, who's doing
issue,
what,
right?
You know. And so they have huge human resource departments, you know, and all this, yeah, right, all the managerial staff and everything, basically to try to work that out, you know.
Category if we try to do so.
Yeah,
you know,
and yet, you know, none of that really works.
More politic. I think that'd be, I don't think,
I'm not sure.
In a way,
I'll stick my neck. I think this, I don't think you want to do this. I mean, I don't think you, I think you can't separate these things out.
Not the measure.
And I think that I think
only,
it's a category
only,
error. I really do.
I agree at one level, but I also wonder.
You do. Yeah, you know.
Well,
thinking
about
you do,
June 30.
You do.
I understand that. But
it's an interesting problem in general.
Some of this
I
don't think there's
been
but it doesn't advance. And actually, it confuses it. It really, it actually does not. I mean, I think what you, I think you need an architecture that you can hang these different functions off of. And if you identify what those are, you've made a huge success. And then implement a subset of this and then a subset of a coordination agreement, whatever that was. Actualizing certain of those mechanisms, then you advance the ball. You've not a perpetuated a category agreement, and you have people.
I think
that,
the challenge
I have to think of these things again.
Is that there are people who are
identify
sort of like
the
negative campaign.
I can't identify. I can't
there are
do all the specifications
who are attacking
where I need
other people
to get where Earth wants us
and tearing down their reputation
in the short term,
strategically.
And so, but I agree that specifying that is critical and may well be what
that itself is relation
for a second. This is a fundamental.
Well, I'm sorry. It happens everywhere. Yes, sure.
Point
I'm sorry,
here,
but it persists online for a long time.
Sort of
I mean, you have
for virtual companies in cyberspace, or is it on the other hand
permanent records
to find an architecture
of disputes?
Right.
You have permanent records
the other
way around too.
Yeah, sure.
No,
okay.
I think it's the online.
Okay. Offline or online?
I knew you would go.
I grant it
then because I think it changes it.
Yeah. because this idea really only works for an online.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's accessible by people who have no way to validate independently what's going on because they're far away.
I think 90% of the companies
are going to be
on the direction you want to go. The
10%. Well, no, that's I'm sorry. What I was trying to get at was that whether it's online or offline is that.
And it's not because it's never 90%.
There are people who are sort of known attackers.
You can do a lot of things digitally you can never have done in the physical world in a certain way.
The
enormous efficiencies and coordination efficiencies.
Work by basically buying a position and carrying into a company with rumors.
Physical aspect of that. It'll be a different kind of organizational structure.
But it comes back also, John, to some of the discussions we've been having. That actually the problems, the interesting problems aren't so much the cooperation payoff matrices as they are the coordination functions.
No one can see their position.
That are so, to some degree independent of
them.
I agree.
It goes
with
back
that.
To, whatever he was talking about with attack.
I think it's the alignment of
it. Very interesting issue here of the
in different parties as these things play out.
As long as we're all trying to work each other's reputations positively.
We've got coffee right over here.
And be accurate. Oh, we're,
very civilized.
It's great. Yeah, but as soon as we've got one or two bad apples in there who are on purpose.